You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
Cool Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff, which is a podcast that comes out twice a week where I talk about people that I think are cool who did cool stuff. And this week is an archetypical episode where I really like the person I'm talking about and the person I'm talking to, who is Chelsea Weber Smith, host of American Hysteria, which is another podcast.
Hey, so happy to be back. I am loving this series so far. It is right up my alley. So thank you so much for having me.
Hell yeah. I'm happy to have you. That sounded fake. That's not true.
Yeah.
It's not
fake. I don't believe
this. Yeah. I hate my job. No, I love my job.
Intimacy is hard. I know.
I know. I'm really bad at So Sophie, hi, is the producer. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
Hi, Sophie.
You gave me the your phone voice. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Sophie.
Hi. Really nailing this.
And I guess our producer, whatever, or audio engineer is Danil.
Hi.
Hi, Danil. You have to say hi, Danil, too. We can't move forward.
Hi, Danil.
Yeah, okay, cool. Our theme music was written for us by On Woman, and this is part two in a two-parter, so the second half, about Oscar fucking Wilde, who probably wouldn't have hated having fucking, although I guess he had enough middle names, he probably didn't need any more.
Remind us of the whole name again.
Oh, but it's all the way back up at the top of my script.
No, all right, don't do it.
Several of them start with F.
Yeah, it's like three Fs.
There's like finial,
Finnegan,
Flaherty.
Well, then something. Fuck works.
Wills, I think Willis or Wills is one of them.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, I totally know this man inside and out. I wouldn't hate to.
No kidding.
So we are talking about Oscar Wilde. And where we last left off, he has reached the pinnacle of his, well, he's just about to put out like his most important works and he is just like fucking killing it. And he loves his kids. He loves his life. And then it's the early 1890s. Oscar Wilde is at the peak of his fame and his power. He's writing plays and essays that will outlive us all. And then he falls for a guy and has a train wreck of a relationship and it just fucks everything up.
Who among us?
I know. In 1891, he meets the man whose father is going to ruin his life.
Ooh.
He meets Lord Alfred Douglas. His friends all call him Bosey, which seems to be a childhood nickname from his like mother called him. It relates to the word boy somehow. I don't understand how English people work. Bosey was a younger man. He was 21 or something. Oscar's in his mid-30s at this point. They hit it off, and they have a love affair full of dramatic breakups and wild goings-ons. Alfred demands Oscar spend basically all of his money on him, and Oscar does. Just whatever fucking Bosey wants, Bosey gets. And they just wrecking ball each other's lives. Just fuck each other up. It's really bad.
Do you think that this is a fuck each other up because they are actually really passionately in love? Or is it hard to say?
So, you know those like relationships where you kind of just fight all the time, but the sex is fucking wild. Mm-hmm. And then whenever you're away, you're like, oh, actually that person wasn't so bad after all. And if he calls, you're like, come running back.
Yeah, I know that exact situation. Okay, all right.
It's one of those.
Got it.
The two of them have a particular habit. One of their favorite ways to spend the time is that they go to a very fancy hotel. They hire sex workers together and then tip the sex workers lavishly. Like they'll send them home with silver cigarette cases and shit. Like,
ooh, okay.
I know. Like,
yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And then they get into big blow up fights and then they get back together. And it is really fucking bad for Oscar. It's probably bad for Bozy too, but he's later going to become a massive anti-Semite, although anti-Nazi.
Okay, well.
Lord Alfred is the man who coined the phrase, the love that dare not speak its name.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of a wannabe intellectual, but he's fucking 21. Oscar Wilde was a wannabe intellectual when he was 21. I was a wannabe, I don't know what I was when I was 21.
I was definitely a wannabe intellectual when I was 21, so.
I know, I was like, I think when I was 17, I was a wannabe intellectual, and when I was like 21, I was like, I'm gonna die in the revolution before I turn 24.
I was a wannabe anarchist by then, too.
yeah. And Oscar Wilde is like hiring him to do stuff he sucks at, like translate his plays and things like that. And then like Oscar Wilde just like go back in and like clean up all the translations and shit.
Wow.
Like at some point, I think what happened is Oscar Wilde like writes a play in French and then like the translation, I think it's the one that Alfred does. And so they date and they're wildly in love and fucking each other up and then having amazing, beautiful, decadent times also. And Alfred's dad is the Marquess of Queensberry. I refuse to learn what a Marquess is. Fucking royalty. I don't even know. Some royalty shit.
Something embarrassing.
Yeah. You ever heard of the Queensberry rules of boxing?
No.
It is the rules that modern boxing is like developed from.
Okay.
Because of the Marquess of Queensberry, this particular man.
All right.
He did not write them down, but he popularized them. And he was big into boxing. And he sets about trying to ruin Oscar Wilde's life because he sees Oscar Wilde as the corrupter, this groomer who has ruined his son. Because as we talked about last time, homosexuality and heterosexuality were brand fucking new terms at this time. I really love it. Actually was like a really mind blowing moment when I realized that heterosexuality is about 120 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know?
But that doesn't mean that before that everyone was like, do whatever you want. It's all groovy, you know?
No, it just meant that there wasn't an identity category. There were like actions that you took. So you like did gay stuff. You weren't necessarily gay stuff yourself.
Yeah. And if you were, it was like words like pervert and things like that.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And as best as I can tell, the way that Oscar Wilde and this particular moral panic about homosexuality, gay men are seen as like vampires. They're corruptors that go around and ruin the young and turn them into corruptors themselves. Pretty much exactly what people say about like trans women now.
Yeah.
So Mr. Queensberry, I refuse to call him Marquess every single time. And I think he would be annoyed if I called him Mr. and I don't like him. So I'm going to call him Mr.
Stick it to him.
Yeah. Take that man who's been dead since before my great grandfather was born. Before my grandfather was born. So he sets about to ruin Oscar Wilde's reputation in life, to save his son from becoming a vampire or whatever. But the first couple times they meet, like they'll be like Bozy and Oscar will be at a restaurant together and like dad will just happen to be there because like all the rich people hang out and do rich people shit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he'll like come over and Oscar Wilde is so fucking charming that he successfully charms his 21-year-old boyfriend's dad multiple times. And so it's like dad will like storm over and like sit down and Oscar Wilde will be like, man, I love fishing. I hear you like fishing. Let's talk about fishing.
Oh man, you this know? Is what I aspire to be for when I meet my partners, like homophobic family members. It's like, I will do it. I will charm you into this, into accepting this. Oh yeah.
And it's like every single time, then he like leaves. He's in my head, he's like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to be mad.
Ah! You know? That vampire.
Yeah. With a charming smile, mm-hmm. handsome abs. So finally, Mr. Boxing Man shows up at Oscar's house and is like, next time I see you and my son together, I'm going to fuck you up. I think he says, I will thrash you, which is nice. 1890s okay. for I'm going to fuck you up. To which Oscar replies, because he is fucking witty and quotable, I don't know what the Queensbury rules are, but the Oscar Wilde rule is to shoot on sight.
Oh, wow.
So he's like, yeah, you want to come at me, I'll fucking kill you, old
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
And
wow.
I think Bosie, Lord Alfred, is egging Wilde on because Lord Alfred hates his fucking dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, Lord Alfred, he shows up at the Rich People London Club that Wilde hangs out at. It was like referred to as like, showed up at his club. And I was like, dear Google, did Oscar Wilde own a club? And then it's like, no, it's just like a weird rich British people thing where you have like your gentleman's club. Actually, this particular one accepted men and women, but it's like your weird rich people club.
Gosh, you know? For a second, I was thinking of Oscar Wilde, like Lindsay Lohan in that one video when she owned that club in Mykonos doing that really, really wild dance.
I do not
dance.
Know the video.
You don't know the video, but it's really funny. It's a great really good. Reference.
Thank you, Sophie.
I would love to go to Oscar Wilde's club, or probably this club that I don't know anything about.
Lindsay Lohan's club in Mykonos became abandoned because she lost interest or something, and I always just dreamed of going to that abandoned club.
She did a reality TV show on her club in Mykonos on MTV, and there was a phase where it was the best worst show on television.
Yeah, it didn't Hell last yeah. long.
For like 6 weeks, because that's yeah. then she lost interest. But she had a fantastic fake accent.
Oh, yeah.
Wild. Well, I know a lot more Wildlife. About pop stars in 1890s London than I do.
That's why we're bringing it in. We're making it modern.
No, I know. I appreciate that. Sometimes I like become conscious of the fact that I like know more about like even like political shit of the 1910s in Ireland than I do about like now. That affects me directly.
Yeah,
you know? I do understand that, but yeah. in American terms, yes.
Yeah. So Oscar Wilde has a club, but not as cool as Oscar Wilde owning a club, which I would absolutely have gone to. And I think if he had lasted, if none of this had gone down, I could see this man owning a club.
Yeah.
And he leaves a calling card, which is another rich people thing. And it says, for Oscar Wilde posing sodomite.
Mm.
Because among his many boxing talents does not include a talent for spelling or comprehensible handwriting.
Okay.
It's sodomite spelled wrong. And Oscar Wilde is like, I'm going to sue this man for libel.
Wow.
And his friends are like, but you're a sodomite.
You're
like, and he will go to jail unless he can prove you are a sodomite, which he can do because you're a sodomite.
Yeah.
And his other friends are like, hey, Paris is lovely. Would you like to go to Paris?
Let's just go to Paris and have a nice time.
Yeah. And he's like, nope, because if I let this stand, it will ruin my reputation. Mm. I am suing this man for libel. My favorite history arguing about, I'm less interested in like, did he fuck so-and-so? That's fine. Why the fuck did he do this is my favorite history arguing about of this whole thing.
Yeah.
So Queensbury now has to prove in court that Oscar Wilde is a sodomite and it's a criminal trial. It's criminal liable. Queensbury is arrested. But the trial never becomes about Queensbury. I think Oscar Wilde sees it like, oh, I'm going to have the power. I'm going to be the prosecutor. I'm going to stand up. I'm going to fight, you know? It is a trial about Oscar Wilde. Mm-hmm. Several times, Oscar Wilde has to be like, hey, I'm the prosecutor, not the defendant.
Yeah. Wow.
And people are like, fuck you, you homo.
Yeah.
You know? Like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Soon enough, Queensbury is found not guilty. And Oscar Wilde gets put on trial instead for gross indecency, a.k.a. touching peens.
So he's after the trial, because of this publicity, he gets charged. with a separate crime.
Because of all the evidence that came out in the course of the trial.
Oh, gosh. Oscar, you didn't have to do that.
No, he did not have to do it. These three trials, there's three trials of fucking Oscar Wilde. They are a big fucking deal.
Yeah. Do you know that?
It is a big deal in history because Oscar Wilde was not the first nor the last celebrity to go on trial for gay sex. But it is coming at a time of public moral panic around, you know, the sodomites in our midst, midst or whatever. And Oscar Wilde is like one of the most famous people around. It also comes at a time when there's two other big scary things going on in England. Irish nationalists and anarchists.
Mm.
And your boy is a gay Irish anarchist.
Yeah. Okay. And what year are we in?
This is 1895. He goes on trial.
95. Okay. Great.
Yeah. I'm going to take a detour really quick to talk about Irish independence and British anarchists, because it's an angle I haven't seen too many people cover, and it's about the trial, and I think it's really interesting. During the 1880s and 1890s, British anarchists were primarily focused on anti-colonialism. In particular, they were focused on freeing the colony next door, Ireland. Anarchists across the world were starting to turn their attention to anti-colonialism everywhere, but it was particularly the case in Britain, which makes some sense.
Yeah.
They also weren't trying to tell the Irish rebels what to do. They weren't like, hey, you all got to be anarchists and do everything anarchy. Instead, they actually looked to the Irish rebels for inspiration and remained in dialogue with movements around the world. They actually did better at this than I expected them to be frank.
Mm-hmm. So they were kind of supporting whatever the Irish nationalists needed versus.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I don't know whether they were like sending arms or not.
Sure.
Right. But I do know that they were some of the only people in England publishing things that were like, we support the following like Irish nationalist crime that had nothing to do with anarchism as a cause. It was just anti-colonial.
Yeah, you know? Ideological support.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And like literally even just being able to get news about it that they were like constantly getting repressed for. This is not a big free speech time, you know?
Right.
And in Britain, anarchists were also like, hey, fellow Brits, you know that whatever repressive shit they do to the Irish, they'll eventually do here, right? And considering the English later invent rubber bullets to use on the Irish, like,
oh, shit.
That's like 80 years later. But
yeah.
But this is exactly what happens. The repressive apparatus that was used against the Irish was then used domestically. And specifically, the spying apparatus was used domestically.
Okay.
And so we're going to talk about the Phoenix Park killings as a sort of cool people detour, just to talk. No one's been stabbed so far this episode, you know?
Yeah.
So some people are going to get stabbed and shot now. And some of them will deserve it. Irish Rebellion was about Irish independence, but it was specifically against landlordism as well. There had been a potato genocide in the 1840s where England had starved Ireland during a period of potato blight. But shit had not gotten better by the 1880s. And so, like, economically. And so you have this next generation who are like, hey, how come we're all tenant farmers instead of owning our land and we're one bad harvest away from death? And also we keep getting evicted, so we're actually not even one bad harvest away from death. We're just dead.
Yeah.
This leads to the Land War of 1879 to 1882, which is a whole fucking war against landlords. And I just want to sit on that pleasant thought for a moment. Although in this particular war against the landlords did come out on top.
Ugh.
Britain by 1881 was like, all right, fuck y'all, Irish motherfuckers. No more trial by jury in Ireland. We are fucking in charge. Not you. Fuck off. They arrested 900 anti-landlord activists. And then the Irish were like, you know, there's just like a couple of guys responsible for that. There's like, well, to quote the great folk singer Utah Phillips, the earth is not dying, it is being killed. And those who are killing it have names and addresses. The Irish were like, well, I can point to those people. That's the guy. One group that came out of this land war was called the Irish National Invincibles, or just the Invincibles, which is a fucking cool name.
Yeah.
And they're a splinter from the Irish Republican Brotherhood. And they were like, what if we just stab the aforementioned responsible men to death in a public park? Surely that's a thing within our power. And they try a couple of times, but they keep failing. But like the little engine that could, they just kept right at it until one day they succeeded. Or, to quote the later IRA, talking about how the later IRA kept trying to blow up Margaret Thatcher. And they said, "You have to get lucky every time. We only have to get lucky once."
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. And I think it was, I think they were specifically mad that Margaret Thatcher was giving Margaret's a bad name.
Yeah.
That's primary problem.
Her greatest sin.
Yeah. So one day in Phoenix Park, seven of these Invincibles surround the permanent undersecretary, Thomas Henry Burke, and the new chief secretary, Lord Frederick Cavendish. The latter of whom had literally just arrived in Dublin to be in charge of repressing the colony. They actually didn't even recognize him, I think. They just were killing the permanent undersecretary and then, like, you know, found this other guy that needed to get stabbed into. And they killed them in Phoenix Park. And unlike the park name, those two did not rise from the ashes.
Ah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The weapons had been delivered by a 7-month pregnant Irish nationalist named Mary Ann Byrne, who ran weapons for the resistance under her skirts. And the getaway driver, the getaway driver was named, and I'm not making this up, Skin the Goat.
Wow. Wow.
All one word hyphenated.
I go to the party at their house. I don't think they're a couple, but I'm pretending they are.
Yeah, totally. There's Mary and Skin the Goat. He earned that name because one time he like killed and skinned a goat and then wore the goat skin on his lap while driving a cab.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Very literal nicknames back then. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So anyway, so the Invincibles killed some men responsible for the subjugation of Ireland. One of the assassins was this guy named James Carey, probably no relation to the actor of the same name. And he got caught and he turned snitch. And his snitching saw five of his associates hanged.
Oh.
And this led to a whole chain of events. The Crown was like, "All right, Jim Carrey, you got to eventually make the mask. So we got to get you away from here under a fake name. Get you to South Africa. You'll be safe there." But there's other people on the boat. And one of the other people on the boat is just, he's not there to do anything. I mean, well, he's there to go to South Africa. But he is a 48-year-old Irish bricklayer named Patrick O'Donnell. And Patrick O'Donnell had been hanging out in coal mining Pennsylvania with his Molly Maguire cousins. See our two-parter on the Molly Maguires, the people who like to kill landlords in the middle of the night. They believed in very direct solutions to certain types of problems. So Patrick discovered James's true identity while they're on the ship together. Three bullets later, James Carey is dead. Patrick O'Donnell stands trial. He's sentenced to death. The judge refused to let him speak after the sentencing. So instead, he shouted. He shouted, "Three cheers for old Ireland. Goodbye, United States. To hell with the British and the British crown."
Nice.
Yeah.
At least he got one in there, yeah.
I know. He was executed and was and is considered a martyr to Irish freedom. A man who made a decision while he was on a boat.
Yeah. Bricklayer, too, which is a cool
years old.
Job. Yeah.
Yeah. What's this got to do with Oscar Wilde? It has two things to do with Oscar Wilde. When Oscar was on his tour of the U.S., he spoke unabashedly about how those killings, the Phoenix Park killings, were, quote, "the fruit of 7 centuries of injustice." And his Irishness is often erased, but he was his mother's son. He also specifically talked about how the colonization of Ireland was cutting into the Irish ability to be artists. The other connection is that the English anarchist press was supporting the Invincibles and Irish nationalism generally. And soon enough, you know, a decade or so later, they're supporting Oscar Wilde. Because not a lot of people supported Oscar Wilde while he was on trial, but the anarchist press did. And as another weird side note about the anarchist press in England at the time, there's this paper called The Torch, and it was run by two teenaged anarchist sisters named Helen and Olivia Rossetti. They started it when they were 13 and 16, and it's like one of the papers of like wide circulation that's like covering shit from all over the world. It's like they're not writing all the pieces. They're like getting all of these people to write all these pieces and stuff, you know?
Wow, that's so cool.
And then here's where it gets really annoying. Another example of the things that Margaret doesn't like to talk about, but has to all the time. Later, these two girls become fascists.
Ugh.
Because
damn.
One of the things I hate talking about is that the fascist movement came out of the revolutionary politics of the left combined with the conservatism and authoritarianism of the right.
Yeah.
It was leftist methodology applied to right-wing values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are leftist roots to a lot of fascism, and a lot of leftists became early fascists. Not
to talk about it, though.
No.
Yeah, you got to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's important.
And it's not fun to. And
no, it's not. But you got to, you know, it's you have to so you don't repeat the past.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. And it's just like annoying because then people will be like, oh, National Socialism, that means it's leftist.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, it's a right-wing movement. And you're like, but also, you know?
Yeah, like, I do know.
So, for now, they are running an anarchist press, and they and other anarchist presses are supporting Irish independence, and a bunch of their writers are supporting Oscar Wilde. So let's get back to the trial. Well, actually, before we talk about the trial, have you ever considered that there's a gaping hole in your life, a hole that you feel like could be filled, but not in a quote Greek way, but through a consumer way? You ever think about that?
I know I do.
So it keeps me up at night. Here's these ads that'll fill your hole. Nope, I don't like. Okay, here they go.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand. Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
And we're back. So like I was saying, the trial is three trials. First, there is Wilde trying to prosecute Boxing Rules Man, and then the Crown trying to prosecute Wilde. And that first attempt to prosecute Wilde doesn't work. There's a hung jury. And so the Crown's like, well, yeah, well, we got you here. Why don't we just put you on trial for the same thing again? And he was like, I mean, I'd probably rather you didn't. And they're like, well, are you going to run to France? And he's like, no. And they're like, why not? And he's like, I don't know. And historians are going to argue about it later. It's 1895. Private investigators during the very first trial, they dig up a fuck ton of the sex workers that he had slept with, and then the Crown blackmails them into testifying against Oscar Wilde. Ugh. I think pretty much they're like, hey, we're going to prosecute you unless you testify.
Yeah.
There's also some implication that they might have been tortured.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of them testify. And I think Oscar Wilde's like a little bit surprised Pikachu face about this.
Yeah.
Like, I think he just thinks he's going to get away with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
His own books and plays are used as evidence against him in these trials. Everyone is trying to tease out every gay line from every one of his plays. And Wilde's defense, it changes tone here and there. By and large, he's not like, being gay is fine, fuck you. By and large, he's like, I didn't do it. Can't say I did it because I didn't do it. Which is, I don't blame, whatever. I'm a big tell the truth person when someone's not threatening to lock you into a cage. You know?
Yeah. You don't need to tell the truth to the courts. That's not going to necessarily show honor. Yeah.
Don't lie to someone that you wouldn't punch. That's my general go-to.
It's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah. So, and partially he gets caught up in a lot of his own lying about this because he can't help being super witty. They're like, hey, did you kiss this guy? And Oscar Wilde's like, well, I would have, but he's ugly. Like, I would never kiss a man like that. And they're like, so you'd kiss a man. And he's like, ah, shit, got me again.
Oh, man.
And the whole time between each of the trials, before the first one, before the second one, and before the third one, his friends are like, go the fuck to France. Why the fuck aren't you in France? In fact, we all left for France because we're all gay and there's now this moral panic around you and we don't want to testify you against you and we don't want to go to prison. So come the fuck to France.
Yeah.
His mother is like, stay and fight.
Wow.
And I don't know whether it's a mama's boy thing. I don't know what it is. But, you know, there's also, like, I get the feeling that he kind of just felt like his whole life was falling apart. Like, I feel like it was like almost kind of a nihilistic move. And he'd just been in this like long, shitty relationship and his life was kind of losing the plot and he was kind of spiraling out of control.
Do we know if his mom was accepting of him being gay?
I don't know.
It would seem so, I guess, unless she was saying like, defend yourself against these accusations. Because there's like two different things that could be.
I know.
Yeah.
I don't know. My guess is supporting mom based on everything I like read about their relationship, but I don't know.
And her politics too. Yeah.
But there's a lot of, you know, it's like one of these things where it's like, well, we'll talk about it.
Sure.
So he defends himself and he actually ends up defending obliquely homosexuality and specifically generation gap relationships that are homosexual. They ask him what the love that dare not speak its name is. And he basically is like, hey, all throughout history, older men have long loved younger men. It's a Greek tradition. Everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like the way he phrases it, you could kind of talk about same-sex relationships if you didn't talk about fucking for a lot of the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the historically close friends were literally just historically close friends. And like you could have, men could talk about loving each other. Because since you hadn't created homosexuality as a vice and a, you know, whatever, like there wasn't like a fear of, you know, you look at all the old photos and like men are like hugging and like
holding hands and like on each other's laps and stuff. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, it means they were all gay. And that's like sometimes true, but it's also just like they weren't afraid of being called gay all the time. So they just enjoyed affection with each other because that's normal and human.
Yeah.
And so it's possible that when he was defending the love that not dare not speak its name, he was like still not being like, you know, and I touched his butthole with my finger or whatever. The first trial ended with a hung jury and he was retried. An Anglican priest who is a Christian socialist put up a fuck ton of money to get Wilde out on bail between the trials and he still wouldn't flee. And it's possible this time he just didn't want to fuck over that priest.
Yeah, yeah.
He went back to court. The judge fucking hated him. Said it was, quote, the worst case he'd ever tried.
Oof.
Because he, like, was, you know, seducing and ruining these, like, young men or whatever, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was convicted of gross indecency. He was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. At the end, Oscar Wilde said simply, "And I, may I say nothing, my lord?" And the judge didn't let him speak, and the crowd jeered him.
Ugh.
I've read a couple academics discussing how the trial wasn't, it was about homosexuality, but it was also about the whole gay Irish radical thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the press treated it that way at this time. Papers were excited to see someone attacked for attacking conventional morality. Yeah. And even this aesthetic movement idea of like art for art's sake is attacking conventional morality by refusing to make art that specifically upholds traditional morality.
Yeah, yeah.
A modern Irish author, Daiglán O'Donohue, wrote, quote, "Unlike anarchist assassins and bombers, who would always be outsiders, Wilde was embedded within the artistic and social elite. His position as a revolutionary who enjoyed popular celebrity meant that he posed a greater threat to the establishment by criticizing it from within, and his enemies in the mainstream press were patiently waiting for an opportunity to punish him for his public success."
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And another piece around this. There's this Irish cop in London who's anti-Irish or anti-Irish independence. His name is Chief Inspector John Sweeney. He was an Irish anti-Fenian who spent a long ass time spying on the Fenians in London, the Irish revolutionaries. And then he moved over to spying on the anarchists. And so the whole, like, the police state will come to affect us too, right? You know?
Mm-hmm.
In the 1890s, British anarchists were largely writing, not blowing things up. A lot of the continental anarchists are in a, like, king-killing stage, but not mm-hmm. the British anarchists so much. So his primary concern was how to censor anarchist speech and how to shut down newspapers and stop ideas from circulating.
Mm-hmm.
This does not feel coincidental.
No.
As soon as Oscar Wilde is on trial, before he's convicted, his name is stripped off the marquees at the theaters running his plays, and soon enough the plays themselves are stopped. The public, like, turns on him on a dime. The press calls him the a laureate of corruption.
Wow.
Everyone
it's
gets
cool
on.
Name.
I know. I'd be all right with that. Like,
yeah. He probably was too. If he wasn't like stuck in jail, he might yeah. have enjoyed it. Yeah.
He has this quote when he's younger that I don't have in front of me. I didn't put it in the script where he's like, "I'm going to be famous or, you know, notorious, whatever." The man accomplished both.
He did it.
And yeah, everyone's on board with stopping his vampirism from corrupting the world. I'm the one making the specific vampirism comparison, but that is the corrupter of youth, the groomer, the, you know.
Yeah, the like hypnotizing force.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, if gay sex makes you gay, it's because you like it.
Anita Bryant did the vampire metaphor for gay men in the 70s.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I should look into
yeah.
that.
She said that because gay men eat sperm, they're eating life itself or something like that. So they're vampires. Yeah.
Oh, this is someone who meant it negatively.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Anita Bryant, the one
okay,
who,
yeah.
She was like the orange juice spokeswoman who kind of single-handedly started the anti-gay movement in the 70s.
Oh, fuck.
So, yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty like into gayness as monstrosity. Like,
yeah, sure.
So I'm like, all right, I'm a vampire, whatever, you know?
Yeah, lots of gays, if not most, enjoy a good horror movie, so.
Yeah. And so he's on trial. Most people are turning their backs on him. He had spoken up for the anarchists 8 years prior, and the anarchists spoke up for him. The broader socialist movement hadn't really grappled with how they felt about homosexuality at this point, including the anarchist movement. They hadn't, like, just sat down and been like, what do we think about this? What's the party line, you know? At least not that I've ever been able to find. I've read a lot about their like grappling with like the woman issue and colonialism and things like that, right? But they hadn't like sat there and thought about homosexuality as a movement. And Oscar Wilde's trial brought pro-homosexuality to the forefront of anarchist politics. And from there, as best as I can conjecture, it filtered out to the broader socialist left. At the time, the broader socialist left despised Oscar Wilde and his homosexuality. Also, they kept being mad at him for not being their style of socialist. You know, it's possible that sure. if he had been a, you know, Marxist, the Marxists would have been like, we're suddenly fine with gays. Or, you know, I don't
yeah.
know.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
It was the anarchist press that kept his essays and plays in print after his fall from grace. I want to say among, because I actually don't specifically know that no one else did, but I know a lot of specific examples when the anarchist press did, when no one else would in various situations. Mm-hmm. It was one of the only places you could go to read about the trial and find things like people saying, hey, what if two consenting adults can do whatever the fuck they want? What the fuck is wrong with you? Even the homophobic anarchists writing were like, hey, did you know you can read Portrait of Dorian Gray without like going out and touching peens with some guy? Like, just stop censoring shit. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
And I kind of love it when people who are like a little bit homophobic are like, well, my values are more important to me than how I have my own weird biases. You know?
Yeah, totally.
But it did not save him, right? There was certainly not a ton of public outcry to defend him. And he went off to prison. 2 years of hard labor is very different than going to prison regular. It's actually almost like a little bit like going to prison regular in the United States now.
Yeah, right.
But like at the time, it was really, really bad. It kills a lot of people. And it functionally kills him. They functionally gave him a death sentence. And what won't kill you or give you a death sentence, unless you get the ad for becoming a jailer, which is a, don't, when I say that we're sponsored by all ads, I mean except the one that says go be a, whatever, here's ads, everything's horrible.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
And we're back. And if you're listening to this in prison while walking on a treadmill endlessly to grind wheat into flour, then you might be Oscar Wilde. Because
is that what it was?
That's one of the things he had to do.
Wow.
He had to walk on a treadmill to grind flour. It took me, most of the sources I found just said like walked on a treadmill. And I'm like, what the fuck? You know?
For why? Yeah.
Yeah. But it really is still kind of just for work. Like he also had to scar his hands permanently to separate old navel ropes, I think soaked in tar or pitch or whatever, into their individual threads.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
in the beginning of his time in prison, he was only allowed to read the Bible and some old Christian book called The Pilgrim's Progress. Eventually, a new warden arrived, and he was offered more books. And he read all kinds of shit in all kinds of languages, especially read a lot of Dante, and he read a lot of theological texts, including this Catholic convert from Anglicanism named John Henry Newman, who wrote a bunch about how every religion, including like heathen religions, contain truth. They contain revelation.
Oh, that's cool.
So he's reading like woke Catholic shit.
Kind of like mysticism or something like that. Gnosticism. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's not allowed to write while he's in jail, except letters. So he writes a 55,000-word letter. it's to Bosey, but it's to everyone. It's a short novel, basically. He had to write it one page at a time because as he finished each page, they'd take it away from him. Sometimes I think people guess, like analysts guess, that he probably had about 3 pages at a time sometimes because of the way the sentences are structured in it. It's a bit of a rambling autobiography as well as a spiritual treatise. And later, when it's out, a copy goes to Lord Alfred de Bosey, and a copy gets published as De Profundis, which is after 5 years after Oscar's death. And De Profundis is a biblical reference, and it means from the depths. It comes from Psalm 130. From the depths I have cried to you, O Lord. So it's basically, it's like, hey, I'm in prison. What it means. And it's a religious text in a way. He talks about how he's realized that suffering is as important to his soul as the hedonism he'd appreciated. He wrote, quote, I wanted to eat of the fruit of all the trees in the garden of the world. And so indeed, I went out and so I lived. My only mistake was that I confined myself so exclusively to the trees of what seemed to me to be the sunlit side of the garden and shunned the other side for its shadow and its gloom. He also wrote, there is not a single wretched man in this wretched place along with me who does not stand in symbolic relation to the very secret of life. For the secret of life is suffering. It is what is hidden behind everything. When we begin to live, what is sweet is so sweet to us, and what is bitter, so bitter, that we inevitably direct all our desires towards pleasures and seek not merely for a month or twain to feed on honeycomb, but for all our years to taste no other food, ignorant all the while that we may really be starving the soul.
Wow, gosh, he was a good writer.
I know.
Like, he was a tremendously good writer.
I know.
Ah.
And so he's not saying, I shouldn't have done the joy sex stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying everything has this value, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Do you think then that he like did feel the criticisms that were leveled against him for being kind of like a frivolous person? Or do you think that like he... Mm-hmm. I'm just interested because that quote is just like, what do you think that he meant exactly when he was saying that? Like, do you think it was reflective of his life?
So I haven't read all De Profundis. I actually read his he wrote a very long poem immediately after that is the main thing I read about it. But I get the impression that he does regret like some of the ways in which he was frivolous,
mm-hmm.
right? But he doesn't regret the like core of it. He stays antinomian. He stays believing that, you know, you don't have to ascribe to a specific moral path in order to reach heaven or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's hard because it's like, there is regret, but then it's like, spoiler, he's going to convert to Catholicism on his deathbed. Mm-hmm. And so there's like Catholic articles that are like, and then he's sorry about being gay. And
sure,
I'm like, I have not found any.
No,
it just meant something very different to him at that time, you know?
And Catholicism just fits so well with his sort of decadence as well, images. It's bloody, it's golden, it's, you know, things he likes, velvety. You know?
Yeah, there's a quote by him about Catholicism from way younger that's at the end of this script. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. I think he's like sorry, he's not sorry. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
And prison fucks him up physically. The food is terrible. Everyone is constantly sick, like everyone's diarrhea constantly. He collapsed from exhaustion one day and he ruptured his eardrum, and this later kills him. He's transferred to another prison, which is Reading Jail, which should be pronounced Reading Gaol because I'm an American and I will never get over how the British spell the word jail.
Is it with a G?
Yeah, G-A-O-L. Mm-hmm.
Weird.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. How do they conquer the world? They don't even know how to write in English.
No.
And while somebody's not impressed. And at one point while he's being transferred, he's under guard on the train platform and a crowd forms around him and like spits on him and jeers him. And this is like presented as the worst, the like lowest time of his prison, even though obviously the like time and, you know, whatever. It sucks. It's bad.
Yeah.
In Reading, he no longer like, they don't call him by his name anymore. He is only C-33. He is on the third floor, the third cell of the C ward. And his mother dies while he's in prison. She appeals to be able to see her son one last time, and this is denied. His wife changes her last name and moves to Switzerland and takes their kids with her. He never sees his children again.
Ugh.
He's forced to declare bankruptcy while he's in prison, and I believe that they're confiscating his copyrights as well as his belongings. In 1897, he's released penniless, and he gets the fuck out of England, and he does what he should have done 10 fucking years earlier, and he goes to France. He never goes back to England. He spends the last 3 years of his life in Paris living under a pseudonym, Sebastian Melmoth, which is a combination of Saint Sebastian, the one who likes getting stabbed and stuff, the Masque of Saint, and then Melmoth the Wanderer from his uncle's book.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I know. It's a good name.
Yeah.
It's a pretty trans mask name, but if anyone's looking for a new trans mask name.
Yeah, there you go.
Sebastian Melmoth. It's right there for you. Although I'll do my follow-up Oscar Wilde was an egg trans woman episode one day.
But yeah, yeah.
That's pure conjecture and or, you know. So at this point, he's out of prison. His primary contributions to society are to write long letters about the need for penal reform. And to write a poem, one of his most famous, called The Ballad of Reading Jail, or as I like to say, The Ballad of Reading Gaol. It's really good. It's very long. It's worth reading. It's very like rhymey, right?
I think he only ever really wrote poems in rhyme.
Yeah, the style at the time.
Yeah. There wasn't a lot of like lyricism yet. Yeah.
I was born in the 20th century. All poetry, it should be free form. I don't understand all of the rhyming,
but
it's really good. And it's really interesting. He can't get it published under his name, right? Because no one will touch it. But it's really good. So it gets published under the name C-33, his jail name.
Wow.
No one in America will touch it at all until the anarchist press is like, all right, well, we'll publish it, which worked really well for the anarchist press.
Yeah.
And I think they actually were like, I think they put his name on it. By the seventh printing in, because it keeps selling out and they keep printing more. It does really well. And it's a moral panic too, which is funny because it is the most like Christian socialist thing you'll read. It is a, it makes you sympathize with a criminal. It is about watching a man get hanged who killed his wife. It is about a man who is not a good man being killed. And it makes you hate the prison system.
Yeah.
It's just really, I don't know. I found it very moving.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, it's terrible. It's immoral. It makes you sympathize with a criminal. And then like some people were like, even like as they were decrying it, they were like, it's forcing you to have really high Christian ethics.
Like, yeah.
And like, it just broke
everyone.
Yeah. It just broke everyone's brains.
Yeah.
His wife was sending him about like, I think £5 a week, which does not translate to a lot in modern money. And that's his like allowance, basically. And that's what he's living off of. And then he gets the royalties from that poem. And he missed his children every day, he talked about. And Robert Ross, Robbie Ross, his lifelong friend, joined him in Paris. Or I think was maybe already in Paris, honestly. But moves in with him. And after a few years, Oscar's health declines. His ruptured eardrum gets infected, which leads to meningitis, which is going to kill him. He died in Paris on November 30th, 1900, at 46 years old. On his deathbed in a rundown hotel, he converted to Catholicism. And his quote that he had once said a long time ago, because he tried to convert to Catholicism a long time ago, and his dad was like, fuck you, you know? He had once said, "The Catholic Church is for saints and sinners alone. For respectable people, the Anglican Church will do." Because it's not extra enough, like what you're saying.
Yeah.
The Catholic Church, you get to drink blood and like be a cannibal.
It's like way cooler.
Like carry around skulls.
Who was with him? Was like, did he have a priest there with him or something? Or how do we know he can do it?
So Robbie Ross went and got a priest who came over. And he's like in and out of consciousness, but he's able to indicate the priest is like, "All right, you doing this?" And he like kind of raises his hand feebly.
Sure.
There doesn't seem to be contention around this.
Okay. Because it makes me almost think, and this is like such a weird example, but like Ted Bundy converting to Christianity at the end and then blaming everything on pornography. And that was like a manipulated thing to like, you know, support a right-wing agenda. So I was just curious if there was any possibility, right, that like this priest had an agenda or something, but sounds like it's not, like you said, it's not argued about too much.
That's the best guess I have. There are a lot of people who are like, "And he was sorry for being gay." And I'm like, I'm not finding a lot of evidence of sorry for being gay. But it is possible. It is possible that this is like, I might be reading it the way that I want to, because he talks about being antinomian. He, you know, to the end of his days, he talks about, like, I feel like I get a sense of like, oh yeah, of course he ended up Catholic. This is the shit he's writing. Rather than like, he fits neatly into the Tradcath assumption of now, you know.
Well, but I don't know. And going to prison too famously makes folks more religious, because you have to have hope in something, and so it would make sense that maybe he found. And he was also being given almost only religious or theological texts.
Well, those are actually what he was asking for. At first, he's stuck with the Bible and the Pilgrim's Progress. Although I don't know if they would have brought him like. Actually, no, because they also did bring him William Pater books. I don't know if they would have given him porn. Yeah. Well, there's some porn in the Bible, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Kinky as shit there is. Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah, no, it's interesting to me, because it's like every read of Oscar Wilde like picks one thing and is like, Oscar Wilde, the Catholic, Oscar Wilde, the Irishman, Oscar Wilde, the anarchist, Oscar Wilde, the meaningless, witty guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you're like, he can just be all those things. And they're things that people want to claim are paradoxical and often can be and are presented as paradoxical. But for me, it just seems like he threaded that needle, you know?
Well, and like who is not paradoxical? Like it's so weird to think that you can't be a paradoxical person.
Yeah,
totally. I feel like I am. I don't know. It's
And his last witticism that apparently he used on like everyone who came to visit him on his deathbed was, "This wallpaper and I are fighting a duel to the death. Either it goes or I do."
It's such a template for this sassy gay man. It's just incredible.
I know. And Robbie Ross was with him as he died, as was the priest. Emma Goldman, I promise you an Emma Goldman quote about him, who herself is quite quotable. She said about him, "While society forgives the criminal, it never forgives the dreamer."
Wow. Yeah.
And one of his sons, Cyril, is killed by a German sniper in 1915 in World War I. His daughter, Dorothy, took after him most directly. She became a witty conversationalist and was an out lesbian.
I didn't know that. That's so nice. Yeah. It feels like he like gets to live on in some way in a different time. Yeah.
Totally. And that's one of the stories about Oscar Wilde. There's 1,000 stories that can be told. I want to shout out that if you want to learn more specifically about how he related to homosexuality, there's a 2-parter from a few years ago by the podcast Queer as Fact that is real worth listening to. But yeah, that's Oscar Wilde, the very different than I thought he would be when I started off reading.
No, I had no idea about probably 80% of what you've told me here today. I just never thought of Oscar Wilde as a political person really in any way, almost anti-political.
Right.
So that's, and do you think that there's any like reason that he's been painted that way and been like almost like, it just feels like the revolutionary side of him has been like cleaned away and almost like, because in my mind, he was like a decadent, kind of almost out of touch rich person who happened to be a beautiful writer and have like, you know, a huge skill with language, but I never thought of him as a radical really in any way.
Well, at one point, I forgot to end it up in the script. At one point, 1892, this anarchist poet is having a mental breakdown, I think, and takes like pot shots at the House of Commons, just like shoots at the wall or whatever. Oscar Wilde pays his bail and writes a letter to him and is like, of course I support you. Like everything is like everything but saying comrade. Doesn't say comrade, but it's like, of course I support you. Like us dreamers have to stick together, you know? I have found that there's certain things that people like not talking about in historical figures. And one of them is gayness, and you can't do it to Oscar Wilde. Yeah. Although people actually try by specifically trying to paint him as a pedophile instead of a gay man.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And one of the other things that people try to write out of history is political positions, especially anarchism, because anarchism is like, it's a harder sell to more people. And there are more political positions that specifically, this is my most conspiratorial I'll probably ever be, but state communists and capitalists both have a vested interest in having people not know about anarchist history. I find that like, it's funny because like social Democrats don't have as much of that. And you'll like see more Ernest actually talking about anarchism within like social Democrat circles. This is my experience of this. So I think that it's a combination. It's also that people don't want to talk about, they want asceticism to be completely vapid and frivolous and don't want to address. And I even thought that I went to art school for 2 years and I hated it. And I hated people walking around being like art for art's sake. And I'm like, well, fuck that. Like, you know, but then once you understand it as like, well, shouldn't we live beautiful lives? Shouldn't we seek to make the spaces that we are in aesthetically pleasing? You know, it's like saying interior design matters. And not that interior design needs to be covered in political posters, but that instead interior design like helps us live beautiful lives and be our best selves. And so I think that it's just that people don't want meaning out of him. You know, they want...
Well, and I guess there's like a big difference between like the aesthetics of like decadence, meaning like that comes out of richness versus like you said, I think we said in part one about like planting wildflowers outside. That's still like they're in service of the same like internal transformation that happens when you witness beauty, because that it's a, it's a transformational act that I think teaches empathy, like experiencing beauty is something that encourages empathy, and it doesn't have to have anything to do with material things. It just has to do with like, I mean, it does have to do with material things, but you know what I mean? It doesn't, there's no caliber of material thing that is beautiful by virtue of it being that way. Right. It's like, you can have like, you know, you can have a mansion that's ugly as fuck, you know, like, and you can have like a space that you've made beautiful without any real wealth, you know? So I think that it's easy to think that beauty is some sort of an elite concept, but it really isn't.
Yeah. And it's funny because one of the things he talks about sometimes is he talks about how one of the reasons that we have to end poverty is so that people can create. And so that they don't have to spend all of their hours working, you know, so that they can create. Like he was also, I didn't even put in it. He's totally fully luxurated, fully automated luxury space communism. He is like, we'll get the machines to do the work so that we can make the art. And of course, now we live in a horrible nightmare inversion of that, where the machines are coming for the art and not the work.
Right.
But yeah, no, I just like, I like him so much more than I was like, oh, he's cool, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but I'm like,
totally.
No, yeah, like socialism for art's sake, not art for socialism's sake. I'm like, I'm on board.
I get Sign it. Me I up. Like it. Yeah, yeah, I love it.
Well, that's
this
the
was
end.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for telling me all of this. I really, like, I feel, I don't know, it's really, it's making me rethink so much about my life, because I've loved Oscar Wilde and in such a, you know, in just such a specific way. And, you know, it really does, like, I think of his grave, you know, which is such a beautiful image for anyone who doesn't know, like he had, I believe, like a marble tombstone. What do you remember what it says?
Oh, it's a quote from De Profundis, but I don't remember what it is.
Okay.
Or maybe it's a quote from the Ballad of Reading Jail.
Yeah, it's something, but people for years and years and years would like put on lipstick and leave lipstick kisses on the grave. And it was just really lovely. And I think a few years ago, they finally like put a horrible plastic barrier all around it.
Yeah, which I think people still kiss.
Yeah, you got to.
Yeah.
Because he would just love that. Yeah. Go kiss Oscar Wilde's grave if you can. Jump the barrier.
And then the person, Robbie, was the person who got the funeral arrangements and stuff in order, and I think was behind the, at first I think he was, it was a very poor grave, and then eventually enough money and enough people came together for it. Like eventually people stopped being so mad at him or whatever, you know? But he added a little, like, there's like a slot in it for his own ashes.
Aww.
And so he had his ashes put in Oscar Wilde's grave.
So it was Oscar, Robbie, and Bosie?
Yeah, so Bosie, they actually did reconnect after, they reconnected really, everyone's like, please don't fucking meet up with Bosie. And they like meet up.
We know that friend of ours, we're like, don't go back and see them.
Yeah, they actually did meet up again a little bit, but they went their separate ways. Like Robbie
was
did they not get
buried by each other?
Oh, is he buried by them?
No, I thought you, who was buried next to
Robbie.
Oscar Wilde?
So Robbie is
Okay,
Robbie has the cremation there. Yeah. No, I think I did say buried next to earlier, and that's not technically accurate.
But still, very sweet.
Yeah. No, and I love it too, because it's like, well, these are the people that we come from. Like, dandies are stronger than we, like thinking about, like, I mean, like queen culture, right? Is like people who have hard lives. I love the idea that someone sees, like, I'm making air quotes here and the audience can't see, but like a man walking down the street dressed like a woman and thinks there's someone who's afraid, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
seriously.
we come from stern stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that doesn't mean we still can't be beautiful and soft and plant flowers everywhere and be limp-wristed and lounge around on chaise lounges. It's just sometimes you have to beat up four men at once and then rob them for their liquor.
And slap the shit out of the school bully, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for being the guest. If people want to hear more of what you have to say, where can they do that?
You can find my podcast, American Hysteria, pretty much anywhere that you listen to podcasts. And you can find me on social media at American Hysteria Podcast, too.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I'll plug, it's been a while at this point, but I finally finished Raw Dog by Jamie Loftus, and it's real good. I listened to the audiobook.
Oh, it's great.
And
so good.
And I love having conversations where, speaking of something that gets presented as surface, you know, it's a book about the history of hot dogs and which hot dogs are best in America. It is also a incredibly radical book and has all kinds of value besides it. So I will shout out that you should go listen to Raw Dog by Jamie Loftus, or I guess read it.
I will say too that if you want more Jamie Loftus hot dog content, I told Jamie a bunch of hot dog related urban legends on American Hysteria once, and that was a lot of fun. So.
Oh shit. I'm going to listen to that. Sophie, you got anything to plug?
Listen to all the podcasts I've made with Jamie Loftus, because I guess we're just doing a Jamie plug.
Yeah, Jamie, the new Oscar Wilde.
Oh.
Oh.
If anyone I can think of that I'm immediately front. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the podcast.
All right. See everyone next week.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit RightRug.com, that's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.